Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second of six Slade Professor of Fine Art lectures for 2021. This is an important tradition at the University of Oxford. It was John Ruskin who gave the first series of lectures on art in 1870, shortly after he was inaugurated as the initial Slade Professor of Fine Art. Ever since, a distinguished scholar has been invited to follow in his footsteps. My name is Geoffrey Batchin, and I am the Professor for History of Art here at the University of Oxford. It is my great pleasure to introduce this year's Slade Professor, Dr. Geraldine D. Dodds. Jerry Dodds is Harlequin Adair Darman Professor, Faculty of Art History at Sarah Lawrence College in the United States. Professor Dodds' scholarly work has centered on medieval Spanish art and architecture, and especially on issues of transculturation and identity formation. Among her many publications are Arts of Intimacy, Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the Making of Castilian Culture, a renowned co-authored textbook. In addition to her other books, catalogues, and essays, Jerry has also curated a number of exhibitions and made films to accompany them. In 2018, in recognition of her exceptional contributions to the dissemination of knowledge of Spanish history and culture, Professor Dodds was the recipient of the Cross of the Order of Civil Merit from the Government of Spain. We are honored that Professor Dodds accepted our invitation to deliver this year's Slade Professor of Fine Art lectures, and I now am honored to hand over the microphone to her. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. My thanks once again to the Committee for Slade Lectures for this enormous honor and for the support of the Department of Art History, the Great Torch team, and Professor Batchin. The great mosque of Cordoba unfolds low and expansive at the city's heart, and from its center grows the 16th century basilica that reminds us that it is today also a cathedral of Cordoba. In 2006, the Diocese of Cordoba surreptitiously registered in its own name a number of properties assumed to be in the public trust, and among those appropriated was this building, which is both the cathedral and a national monument. For a medievalist, it's kind of thrilling in an anachronistic sort of way to see a cathedral chapter flex its muscles in this day and age, but in this case portends danger in a host of ways. Religious consecration, responded the local government, is not the way to acquire property. They were clearly not medievalists, and they were especially not Hispanists, for whom the acquisition of property is all about religious consecration. Through public outcry and various legal contests, the Cathedral Chapter of Cordoba has aggressively intervened in the construction of a tightly controlled historical narrative centered around Christian physical and ideological possession of the building, instrumentalizing the monumental 16th century church inscribed at its center to create a teleological structure of Reconquista, in which the site and building are seen as primordially Christian, while the mosque building is, and I quote, the Islamic intervention between a fictive church and the present cathedral. And this is the flyer that you get, and it talks about the history of the church, and the entire mosque structure is called an Islamic intervention in this Christian history. This level of discursive control is offered in opposition, of course, to popular secular narratives, the commodified convivencia we spoke about last week, celebrating an idealized religious pluralism in its most reductive form, exploited by a growing tourist economy in what Watson and Waterton called a consumption of otherness, the frisson of exoticism met in encountering an enormous mosque possessing the center of a European city. But was there a thrill of exoticism in the beginning? Did the forms of the mosque constitute a symbol of sectarian defiance when it was first constructed? I'd like to consider these thoughts today in two discussions. The first, how did the mosque take its place in the new Umayyad capital, the hitherto very Christian city of Cordoba? And then, 200 years later, How other was the material form of the Great Mosque of Cordoba in the grand period of the 10th century Caliphate? Between 711 and 718, several expeditions of troops under the command of an enterprising Tariq ibn Ziyad crossed the narrow straits that separated North Africa from Spain, in time defeating the Visigothic monarchy, already fragmented by civil war and internal strife. Much of the Visigothic and Hispano-Roman elite took advantage of the pacts offered by the conquerors, through which they could maintain their estates and the practice of their religion. And it's probably to pragmatism on both sides, together with military conquest, that the Umayyad forces triumphed. This occupation was composed not only of Arabs, Visigoths, and Hispano-Romans, but also of restive Berbers and Syrians, engulfed in mutual suspicion and militant rivalries, making it difficult to establish a stable provincial rule. 6 years after the initial conquest, the capital of Al-Andalus was transferred from Seville to Cordoba, probably because Seville's Visigothic aristocracy was still resistant and peevishly intent on asserting their pactual rights to their own property, while local elites were displaced from Cordoba's intramural palaces, leaving the new conquerors more of a free urbanistic hand. The late antique city of Cordoba had been established close to the river in the southwestern section of the city, and it was here that the new Medina, the new city, was constructed, appropriating late antique locations for civil and religious authority. The presence of a congregational mosque, where the Muslim community joined for prayer on Fridays, was an essential first step in establishing a colonial presence. The little square in blue indicates the first stage of the later mosque and the probable position of the original mosque, which was likely, however, smaller. Its functions were religious, political, and social, as the place in which the community prayed together and experienced its unity, and also from which the imam led the community in declaring its allegiance to its ruler, among other ceremonies of authority. But in this early period, mosques were likely rudimentary on the Iberian Peninsula, and they did not require the erasure of other confessions. Though, of course, conflictive images of churches and mosques loom large in Iberian historiography. Militant Arabic texts that spoke of the destruction of churches to make way for triumphant mosques have been exposed as legitimizing tropes composed long after the fact, as have more recent utopian narratives about systemic tolerance. Of use here is the capitulation treaty made in 713 between Abdelaziz and the Visigothic Tudmir, governor of the region of the southeast part of the peninsula, and here it's in pink. It promises that Christians, quote, will not be coerced in matters of religion, their churches will not be burned, nor will sacred objects be taken, so long as Tudmir fulfills the conditions we have set for him. These were privileges that could be accorded to dhimmi, usually Christians or Jews, whose rights to worship and to conduct their own communal affairs were established by pacts offered to the communities who capitulated. Such pacts helped to buttress the progress of conquest and colonization, but the conditions of Christians and Jews could vary widely because the church of a resisting population was not thus protected, and there were many complex legal questions in between, which might be why Seville kept its indigenous elites, but Cordoba less so. The history of the construction of the first congregational mosque of Cordoba lies between these two discourses and is unremarkably still a hot issue, because part of the narrative to which the cathedral chapter of Cordoba clings today concerns a basilica of St. Vincent proposed by Ibn Idari, incorporating an earlier chronicle in his 14th century Bayan al-Mughri. He recounts that the earliest Muslim conquerors of Al-Andalus followed the practice of the Umayyads of Damascus by sharing the space of a monastery of St. Vincent in Cordoba with the Christians, until in the 8th century, the new Umayyad emir Abdulrahman I later purchased the entire site from the Christians to enlarge his mosque. This is an unlikely history, as it's stated. We can find no monastery of St. Vincent in Cordoba, either in texts or in archaeology. And chronicles closer to time and place do not make a mention of this. The account is so clearly meant to ally the founding of the Great Mosque of Cordoba with an almost identical account concerning the Umayyad Mosque of Damascus that it was likely a legitimizing topos, one that's been repurposed by today's cathedral. A window that you see on the right, constructed into the vestiges of a late antique floor mosaic that has been excavated by today's cathedral, of a late antique floor mosaic, is labeled the Basilica of San Vicente, but it's located in a place that had no mosque over it until 987, that's the red arrow, 2 centuries later than Abdurrahman's building. But the mosaic and the window materialize so graphically that trope of replacement, the obsession with the notion of erasure of a Christian church, that it has propelled even the scholarly discourse into 2 poles. There was a church, there was no church. When the situation was more interesting, if less satisfying from an ideological point of view for either side, I'm happy to say. Predictably, it is Professor Susana Calvo Capilla, who is now the mosque's most important chronicler, who points to excavations that have revealed a martyrium dedicated to St. Vincent, not in Cordoba, but in Valencia, one which fell into ruin during the 8th century and was replaced soon after by a mosque. This same process occurred in Zaragoza and Seville, opening up an alternative scenario of a gradual process of appropriation of urban topography, such as that chronicled by Mattia Giudetti in Syria, in which early mosques were often built contiguous to, but usually not on top of, existing churches in the nexus of towns' mercantile and administrative centers. Until the acceleration of conversion to Islam caused the abandonment of church buildings. Calvo has pointed to texts that speak of a large functioning church within the confines of the Medina of Cordoba, at the same time as the earliest mosque, a narrative that suggests something like this same process. And in an unusual conversion of documentary and archaeological data, Gutierrez Lloret has demonstrated that the same thing happened in the episcopal city of Ayo, one of the very sites named in the Treaty of Tudmir that we quoted earlier. Ayo's church survived long after the famous pact that protected it, until it was slowly abandoned, while the mosque was built in another part of the urban center altogether. This looks very much to me like what happened in Cordoba, where the mosque was built over an extensive episcopal complex without necessarily displacing all its churches. Cordoba would wait, however, for the arrival of the Umayyad exile Abdurrahman I for the beginning of the construction of the mosque we see today. Far from Cordoba, a revolution had occurred in 750, as Abbasids defeated the Umayyad Caliphate and moved their capital to accommodate an Islamic world continuing expanding to the east. The Abbasids had hunted and killed most of the Umayyads, but a great nephew of the Umayyad Caliph al-Walid, Abdurrahman, had evaded capture. Al-Makari conveys a fabulous fragment from Ibn Hayyan of what was purported to be Abdurrahman's own account of his desperate escape across the Euphrates River, the murder of his brother by Abbasid agents, and a secret crossing to Ifriqiya, where his mother's people, the Nafsa Berbers, resided. From there, after long negotiations, he crossed to an Iberia that seemed, to those who lived in Damascus or Baghdad, a wild, remote frontier over which the Abbasids would ultimately relinquish practical hold. A place that had deep divisions already between different Arab tribes, Syrians, vestiges of a shattered Roman and Visigothic aristocracy, and Berbers, who resented their secondary status in a promised egalitarian Islamic Ummah. All of these groups were by now long rooted in independent power nuclei in the peninsula and did not yield easily to central control. Christians were the least of Abdurrahman's problems. It would take Abdurrahman nearly 30 years to unify this new state an act symbolized by the construction of the mosque that would visualize his new consolidated emirate or princedom and reify his authority as imam. But how was Abd al-Rahman to give this building in a restive Al-Andalus a coherence that was not rooted in its connection to the central Abbasid caliphate from which he was now politically estranged? This kind of hypostyle plan that he uses is quite conservative. It used the language of late antique architecture in a prayer hall wider than long, subverting hierarchy so that the aisles appeared without the culminatory effect of, for instance, a Christian basilica, emphasizing instead the collective experience of the community over axial authority. Abd al-Rahman would visualize his new mosque, I think, as an offshoot of the imperial building program of his great uncle, Al-Walid I, the Umayyad Caliph, who codified so many of the forms of the mosque. This forest of columns, 11 aisles, with a slightly wider central aisle, running all of them running perpendicular to the Qibla, the wall facing Mecca, possibly reflected the prayer hall of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. But it might also, in its simplicity, evoke an Iberian tradition reaching back to the first Umayyad conquerors of the peninsula, to an Iberian Umayyad heritage sanctified by its antiquity and one that preceded Abbasid authority. Regarding Damascus, it has been cautioned that such direct reference, as I'm referring to, so far from the capital is unlikely. And yet, consider Abd al-Rahman's experience, his connection to Damascus, from which he was exiled, and his need to unify and legitimize his new polity under his family name. In perpetuating this early plan, Abd al-Rahman could visually construct a new foundational history for Umayyad al-Andalus, one that could imbue the peninsula with its own essential Islamic authority, separate from that claimed by the Abbasid Caliphate. But here in elevation is also something far more complicated. Its startling and new effect, a forest of columns with a permeable elevation of superposed arches, an animated, almost provocative polychromy. Marseille noticed that the double arches of the aqueduct of Merida provide a solution for lifting the ceiling of Cordoba's hypostyle hall, much as a row of windows does in Damascus, so that its expansive space does not become oppressive. But the effect here is totally new and fabulously complex. A conventional late antique arcade below and a second elevated arcade above, fragmenting one's vision of the whole into ambiguous, overlapping lateral spaces. A kind of hall of mirror in which it's difficult to situate oneself or to judge distances with clarity, so that experience capitulates to multiple perspectives. Abd al-Rahman could not reproduce the colossal scale or gilded mosaics of the mosque built by his great uncle, the Great Mosque of Damascus. However, at Cordoba, as at Damascus, something of the same theory of imperial self-representation is at work. Abd al-Rahman's Cordoba originally had a concave mihrab, a niche located on the Qibla wall, indicating the director of prayer, a form first introduced by Al-Walid in Medina and Damascus that would become a standard feature of mosque architecture. It might also carry the memory of the presence of the first imam, of light, and other royal associations. And as at Damascus, the mihrab here took the form of a scallop shell. Susanna Calvo has shown was paid at Cordoba to the use of local spolia, both classical and late antique, a classical language repurposed not as an effect, not as a reference to Rome, but to serve as a connection to this imperial Umayyad past. For the Umayyad cultural system in culture, administration, and architecture, Giudetti maintains, took root in the late antique core. Arieta Papakonstantinou has shown the Umayyad system of adoption of pre-existing late antique labor and contract systems and the laborer themselves as well, something clearly at work in Cordoba. She sees this as part of a conscious process of Umayyad reclaiming the standard practices of imperial lineage. It is manifest here in the systematic, but neither exclusive nor mindless use of the horseshoe arch in its local aesthetic and constructional avatar in the midst of a building that's otherwise formally inventive and meticulous in its references. So the horseshoe arch is used in the lower arches, in the superposed arches of the Great Mosque of Cordoba, but there are, of course, in the upper arches, semicircular arches. That is to say, they're using the horseshoe arch inventively, but also quite consciously. It's not a knee-jerk building construction thing that's going on here. But then the aqueduct brings something else with it. It brings the means by which the mosque's strident polychromy was achieved. The alternation of stone and brick was widely used in civic projects in the late Roman Empire, though at Merida, it is unsure if the alternation existed in the arches, where it would have been technically more expensive and practically unnecessary. At Cordoba, however, stone voussoirs alternate with red bricks, which had to be individually shaved to fit with the wedge shape of the stone voussoirs. So then we need to ask, at Cordoba, had Merida's red and white masonry just come along for the ride, as Cordoba's designers appropriated the doubled arches, as is often said? But okay, can you imagine a motif so carefully conceived so that it completely dominates our impression of the interior of the mosque to the extent that it becomes its primary signifier? Can you conceive of this as passively adopted? I do not think so, because this way of making banded arches presented Abd al-Rahman with local techniques and material that could recall the opulent opus sectile of the great mosque of the great Umayyad monuments that constituted his lost heritage, the Dome of the Rock or the Great Mosque of Damascus. Abd al-Rahman knew the great Umayyad monuments, not as symbols or as literary topoi, but as personal memories projected onto his political identity. These are the monuments envisioned imperfectly, or better said, locally, at the Great Mosque of Cordoba through the gifts and limitations of an indigenous building tradition. For a prince who bore, among his many titles, descent of the Umayyad caliphs. For a prince who was trying to picture a way of being Iberian and Umayyad in an Abbasid world. This was a theater for the proclamation of political authority, the unfurling of standards before the departure for war. The building of the Mosque of Abd al-Rahman I in 787 marked materially the passage of Al-Andalus from a chaotic, fragmented, and remote province of bickering strongmen into a state. The mosque endowed that state with an identity separate from that of the Abbasid Caliphate that vanquished his family. It represented a polity that was to be as Iberian as the Abbasid's architecture was Mesopotamian. It carried the standard of the new Umayyad state at the periphery of the Dar al-Islam. The polychromy then appeared in the earliest exterior gate of the mosque, the Bab al-Wuzara, in subsequent ones, in its broad composition of in the same broad composition of those of Umayyad palaces in Syria, but now in a form that has become emblematic of the new Spanish Umayyad princedom. A horseshoe arch door with a wide extradose, alternating red and white voussoirs, and framed by a rectangular molding called an alfiz. Consciousness of the explicit meanings of these forms is found in their durable afterlife. For over two centuries, in each of the subsequent additions to the mosque, we can read unswerving reverence to this same elevation under Abd al-Rahman II, in the long axial extension to the mosque by al-Hakam II, through to the final 11th century additions to the mosque by Al-Mansur. where the arches were constructed entirely of stone. So the effect of revetment was achieved by painting red and white patterns that, like marble revetment, was not tied to the voussoirs below. Why would you paint stone? Because the effect of alternation and polychromy encased the message of Umayyad antiquity together with local authority, a sense of continuity carefully preserved by each of Cordoba's rulers for over 200 years. So I'd like now to step back to the 10th century, to the height of the Iberian Umayyad power. Cordoba was now the most powerful city in Europe and its most influential cultural capital. This was the moment in which, if the little mosque of Ibn Hadidi we talked about last week was the periphery, the great mosque of Cordoba was at the center. And I realized after I made the title of this that I had taken the title subconsciously from one of Tom Nixon's chapters in Toledo Cathedral. But it sort of makes sense. Both of these are pivotal monuments that represent both peripheries and centers. In 929, Prince Abdulrahman III declared the Spanish Umayyads to be not just princes, but caliphs in their own rights. Proclamations of caliphal authority by Shiite Fatimids in North Africa had provided both a challenge and license to the Umayyads of Cordoba, who were also eager to defy the Abbasids as leaders of the Sunni community. Abdulrahman III's monumental expression of this act would be his palace city of Medina al-Zahra, with its terraced apartments and grand basilical reception hall, which you see here, all marked by radically enclosed horseshoe arches with alternating voussoirs, now a clear marker of Umayyad identity and a connection with his eponymous forebearer. It would fall to his son, Al-Hakam II, to construct a monumental addition to the mosque in 965 as part of his dawah, or political religious propaganda. Indeed, Susanna Calvo has seen this enlargement as a kind of political stage set, an idea I would like to support and expand upon while taking a moment to assail one of my own theories. Al-Hakam II's addition to the mosque were opulent statements of dynastic renewal. He lengthened the prayer hall 12 bays in the direction of the Qibla, converting a wide covered hall into a longitudinal directional one. It now culminated in an elaborate new moksura, an enclosure reserved for the prince, preceded by three domes and covered throughout with gold and colored mosaic tesserae, a material and craft hitherto unknown on the Iberian Peninsula. Ibn Idari would later recount that Al-Hakam had written to the king of the Rum, the Byzantines, to send a capable worker in imitation of that which Al-Walid ibn Abd al-Malik did at the time of the construction of the Mosque of Damascus. Al-Hakam's act of patronage following his father's reclaiming of the Umayyads' authority as caliph might be seen as completing the meaning of the mosque of their ancestor, Abdulrahman I, by incorporating brilliant mosaics as a direct reference to Damascus and monumental inscriptions that recalled the early Umayyads' introduction of Arabic inscriptions in the Dome of the Rock. These were material expressions of histories being codified in court, expressions of continuity that were visual challenges to Fatimid and Abbasid claims of authority. At Cordoba, the mosaics include meaningful vegetal forms, but are largely organized around the schematized architectural emblem of the Iberian Umayyads, a broad horseshoe arch embraced by an alfiz, banded arches now covered in a complex play of figuring ground, folded into a rigid iconographical discourse of Umayyad revival and authority that marks for us the conscious meaning of the mosque as a political instrument. In this chronological context, we need to place the roots of the story of the sharing of the Church of St. Vincent. It is, after all, encountered in Ibn Idari, but he cites as his source an earlier chronicle who wrote this explicit comparison between Damascus and Cordoba in the 10th century, in the moment in which scholars began the conscious construction of the history of Al-Andalus and revealed in particular through excerpts in the work of the Muqtabis of In Hayyan, what Martinez Gross speaks of, an imaginaire of the Umayyads in this period, an imaginaire of the Umayyads which has as its goal a return to the Umayyad Caliphate, not only of its old territories, but the threads of its own history. But then, how does the architectural form of this Muqsura fit into the weave of this Umayyad imaginaire? It has not only a deep mihrab, like a room, but three openings, doors into a treasury and a sabat, which is a direct passage into the palace, and each of those surmounted by a ribbed dome. And a three-aisled basilical space extends from it, marked by two screens of fabulously mannerist polylobed tasbih, these interlacing arches that create the illusion of an interwoven architecture collapsed in space. A second illuminated ribbed dome marks the foot of the space, one of three domes originally, as Juan Carlos Ruiz discovered. There are many axial forms associated with muqsuras and mihrab aisles, but this three-aisled space announced by luminous domes is unique in the Muslim world. So why is this not about Christians? A three-aisled basilica, a mihrab in the form of a deep room like an apse, and the decorative treatment of the entries to its treasury and sabat all echo the east ends in both elevation and plan of contemporary three-apsed Christian basilicas like San Miguel de Escalada or the Basilica at Bobastro. And the screens of arches seem like wild elaborations of the divisions created by an altar screen like that of Escalada. At least I used to think so. This disposition reflects a division of space that belongs to a long-standing Christian liturgical development on the peninsula, I used to think. After all, connected to an even more venerable Byzantine one. But why would this muqsura look like a church? That is a boundary not easily franchised in the confessional realm. And then, why not? I imagined that the muqsura was the immediate reflection of local Christian models, masked, or you might say blondered, of Christian ecclesiastical content through their use first in a secular context, in the reception hall of Medina Zahra, for instance, a three-aisled basilical hall that culminated in three banded horseshoe arches, the center one of which enframed the caliph as he was seated on a dais. These arches are not doors. They're only enframing devices that demonstrate the extent to which the banded horseshoe arch with a wide profile had literally become an emblem of neo-Umayyad caliphal dignity. So the three-aisled muqsura of Al-Hakam II reflected this basilical audience hall of the palace, underscoring the authority of the caliph within the precincts of the mosque, that reception hall in turn echoing the axial throne halls of both Umayyads and Abbasids. The connection between the mosque and the palace draws a fine thread from the site of the caliph's religious authority to his political home in the suburban palace city, one fortified by a formal processional route that ran from Cordoba to Medina al-Zahra. There, a guest must walk between two rows of court retainers, just as Barceló reconstructs it here in the Id reception of 960 at Medina al-Zahra. The long aisles in palace and mosque provided an extended stage set for the performance of authority and the articulation of hierarchies, in which the side aisles indicate distance from the center of power, modeling, Safran revealed, the caliph's claim to be the source of order and stability. But though basilical plans had abounded in palatial concepts and contexts, and mosques throughout the Mediterranean, the particular way in which this was articulated brought one back to these 10th century churches. There had been dramatic events among the Dhimmi in Al-Andalus, a rash of voluntary martyrs of resistant Christians in the 9th century, and a revolt of Mualladun, indigenous converts to Islam, along with rural Christians and Muslims, under the renegade Umar ibn Hafsun, who was said to have converted to Christianity. And there were texts recognizing the rhetorical power of Christian practice during these revolts. Al-Idrisi reminds us that the treasury of this Maqsura was a Quran in which are four folios from the Musaf of Uthman ibn Affan, and that this is the copy which he wrote with his very hand, and on it are drops of his blood. Uthman was the martyred progenitor of the Umayyads, whose ultimate legacy lay in their descent from him. According to Al-Idrisi, the codex was carried in procession in this Maqsura, preceded by an authority who carries a candle before it's brought to a lectern where the imam gave the customary reading. Processions with candles were extremely unusual in mosques and very frequent in churches. Indeed, this procession is almost identical to the reading of the gospel in the Hispanic liturgy, in which it was processed to the lectern, accompanied by a monk with a candle. Travis Sade points out that Al-Razi, who wrote from the 10th century, discusses the Musaf in a depth that heightens the credibility of this report, thus I think putting aside recent claims that this is an Almohad invention. The appropriation was clearly not meant to directly reflect Christian practice, but rather to garner something of the rhetorical power of that practice in a time when the affective power of Christian worship had been on display for a century in Cordoba. Perhaps it was possible that the use of these recognizable, rhetorically powerful spaces and practices were appropriated and then redirected as performances of Umayyad history and legitimacy in the case of the procession, or in the case of the Maqsura, redirected through the use of anti-Christian epigraphic rhetoric. In surahs denying the divine nature of Jesus located along the Qibla, on the doorway of the Sabbat, for instance, is this: creator of heaven and earth, how should he have a son when he has no consort? And on a nearby portal, God forbid that he himself should beget a son. However, it's always more complicated, isn't it? As Susanna Calvo, in her careful study of the epigraphy of the mosque, now shows, these texts occur in a far broader ideological context. They are Quranic responses to three heterodox threats, of which Christianity was just one, in an epigraphic program meant to support the religious elite in serving the image of the caliphate as a defender of Sunni orthodoxy. The main target was not Christians in general, but the rebellion of Umar ibn Hafsun, whose supposed apostasy and that of his sons had threatened Abdulrahman III's role as defender of orthodoxy. The suppression of his revolt was among the most important victories of Abdulrahman III, on which, with other victories, he built his new dawla as caliph. And Ibn Hafsun had also attempted to ally himself with enemies of the Umayyads, and this gave Abdulrahman III a chance to conquer his enemies by proxy. Submitted Christians in the Spanish Umayyad states were, Safran reminds us, part of the larger political community. Their mutual security was integrally associated with the Islamic legitimacy of Umayyad rule. And while jurists were concerned about religious transgressions, apostasy, and contamination with Christians, Christie's has shown that there's little general anti-Christian polemic in Al-Andalus until the 11th century. Christianity is present in this Maqsura, but not Christianity writ large. The religion itself is a minor player in the game of political identities and anxieties. And so if you're not, as I was, focused uniquely on religious difference in this Maqsura, the world becomes a little larger. Because we sort of rushed back past Samarra, the royal Abbasid city. Of course, it was the Abbasids against whom the Spanish Umayyads had fashioned their political identity, but they also represented a challenge and a potent model. The 10th century shift in focus from urban palaces to sprawling Palatine complexes outside of urban centers would be shared in both realms. And in fact, the Umayyads followed the Abbasids in creating a changing image of the caliph into a more remote ceremonial figure of difficult access. And the Abbasid city of Samarra had an impact in other ways as well. The three openings in the Moqsura at Cordoba connects not only to Spanish and Byzantine churches, but also to the same functions at the Great Mosque of Samarra. And there's archaeological evidence that the Abbasids were using gold tesserae in their mihrab. We can begin to see Samarra's Moqsura transmitted in written accounts as a catalyst for Al-Hakam's push to such opulence, although he translates it, the models for the mosaics and the three Moqsura openings, into an expansive language about Umayyad continuity and legitimacy, essentially turning the Abbasids' own opulence against them. The forms that I saw as so Christians were those first adopted from Hispano-Roman traditions in the first years of the Umayyad Emirate and developed over time to serve an Iberian Umayyad identity. And now they rose to support the new caliphate, to mark the three openings as Umayyad, not Abbasid. The basilica is somatically consistent across time as a form, but it is protean and flexible in its specific iconographic applications. By the time they appeared in Al-Hakam II's Moqsura, these forms had already evolved in a transcultural Mediterranean space for centuries, tracing a cognitive map for the performance of hierarchy at the intersection of secular authority and the divine that was exploited eagerly and with full entitlement on both sides of the confessional divide. Here, they are more semantically heated in the service of defying other Islamic realms, an iconography that allows other similarities to subside. The deep room-like mihrab expresses this convergence of meanings. Its dome is in the form of a scallop shell, connecting to the original mihrab niche of the Mosque of Abdulrahman I, and ultimately to the earliest mihrabs, once again, of Al-Walid and of Damascus. And yet, while it seems focused squarely on expressing Umayyad authority and renewal, I am not sure the 10th century audience was oblivious to its vestigial meanings, peering out from the palimpsest of its formal history. I'm remembering the procession before this mihrab, described by Ibn Idari, and also a remark of Ibn Hazm. Born to an Umayyad court official in the last years of the caliphate, Ibn Hazm led a tumultuous life after its fall, before turning to study and writing in 1027. Born less than 20 years after the death of Al-Hakam II, he certainly knew Cordoba. His discussion of legislation regarding mosque building is interesting for us here. It's in his voluminous treaty on jurisprudence, Al-Muhalla. Ibn Hazm begins his section on mosques, moral precaution against architecture, by accepting the theoretical position of other traditionalists that rejects the mihrab as a blameworthy innovation, one that does not conform to the tradition of the Prophet. The reasons offered for this are the fear of imitating Christian churches and also of introducing luxury into the precincts of the mosque. Of course, in practice, regarding the use of mihrabs, the horse had already left the barn. Ibn Hazm's eloquent interpreter, José Miguel Puerta Vilches, remarks that, as regards architecture, Ibn Hazm was, quote, not always in line with the constructive realities of his time. But we can read in these short comments that the association of any mihrab, let alone Cordoba's, with the apse of a church was a matter of open discussion. I take this to mean that, however much the Qibla of Al-Hakam II has reinvented its antique Abbasid and Spanish roots, that its audience was not oblivious to this connection. It still bore a vestigial association with church building through all of those physical and temporal stratigraphies of interaction. Despite his disapproval, what Ibn Hazm shows us is that those associations must not have been very threatening, that they paled next to the importance of facing down Fatimids and Abbasids. They paled next to the construction of Umayyad identity that the Maqsura projected. Memory, writes Elena Arrighita in a moving essay about today's mosque cathedral, memory accommodates only those facts that suit it. It thrives on vague, telescoping reminiscences. It is vulnerable to transferences and projections of all kinds. As confessions, both Islam and Christianity demand boundaries in confessional spaces, expressions of religious purity. But in their material manifestations, these barriers were easily franchised because they were built of a shared lexicon of forms that excited latent meanings of divine hierarchy and unmediated authority in the early medieval collective conscious. And though we like to imagine that the separation between religions required blindness to this kind of latent intimacy, such boundaries did indeed yield to an occasional flicker of consciousness. But why, really, in the end, would we be the only ones to see? Thank you.